could derive out of the sea waves is the mass of the energy arrived. And in order to explain that, we were able to explain that only by a fast structure and sustainment. And another possibility was raised by Sekiguchi and Iwata, and by also Anderson, saying that maybe an event was triggered, sleep was triggered here by the P wave coming from the upper center. But what I believe, and what I think most people, many people believe now, is that it was super sheer rupture from near the epicenter to about the middle. So let's look at the geometry of the rupture, again measured in the field by geologists after the earthquake. So the epicenter is here. This is the area over which super shear occurred, and this is the total area from here to here of rupture. And where you have a black triangle, that means you have a high segmentation feature of the rupture. And when you have a small open triangle, that means a small segmentation feature. And you see that all along the super shear segment, which is extremely remarkably straight, you have only small features of segmentation. So maybe small stepovers, for instance. And except under here, but this is under a lake, so this is just not seen, this segmentation feature here. These are just successes. And this is an observation from space of the rupture. It's an interferometry image between two optical images. And indeed, where the rupture is really seen clearly, it's from here to here, and it's exactly the super shear segment. After that, the rupture becomes, the image of the rupture is more fuzzy, which may imply that the deformation is not so so well localized. Further on, but from the epicenter to here, where we have the superficial segment, you see from space a very straight line of rupture. And what these authors said is that the surface rupture seems remarkably similar. And that's what all the authors, all the people who studied that the rupture trace say. This is the rupture trace of the earthquake, where you have about 3 meters displacement from one side to the other side, and you see the very strong localization of the deformation. Another image, the rupture goes perpendicularly to this structure. And you see it caps really like a knife through that. So 3 months after it meets, there was a Duce earthquake. And this is a map of the Duce rupture, which is meet rupture stops here, came from the east, from the west, sorry, stops here. And this is 3 months later, the rupture of the Duce earthquake. And again, it's a bilateral event. The epicenter is not on the fault trace because now the fault dips by about 65 degrees to the north. The epicenter is at 12 kilometers, so it's offset from the surface trace. What was inferred by several authors here is that rupture went very fast on this segment here. And at sub-relay velocity here. And from the surfaces. This is the surface trace obtained by Cucci. And Cucci is an Italian geologist. He did his PhD on this function. And what he says, over, at the conclusion of his work, he says, overall, we recognize two different sections of the Duvier segment. A western section, where the cosine slip fault trace has a staircase trajectory. And an eastern section here, where the cosine slip fault trace shows a trail trajectory and crosscuts the older and complex fault system. And at the time, we inferred fast rupture in that area here. We have no idea that the rupture trace was much smaller here than here. So again, what it seems is that the fast structure seems to occur on the very simple geometry of the fault plate. Now you have a couple of years later, the Kunlun earthquake, the largest continental rupture for an earthquake ever observed. And this is a topographic map of the area of the Kunlun earthquake. And the epicenter was to the west, and this is the rupture length is shown by the dot. And what these authors inferred is they inferred that the rupture started rather slowly, several feet here, in the complex area, which is kind of a horse-tailed beginning of the long Kunlun fault, which is going to go on for one of the longest active faults in the U.S. But when the rupture reached the very linear segment that you see here in the topography, it went high speed. And indeed, here it went straight instead of continuing on the main Kunlun fault, which is here. This segment ends from here. But it chose to go straight instead of turning on another segment. So again, what seems to be seen here is a very web rupture where we have some observations which tend to show that rupture goes very fast. Very simple linear structure. This is just a map from satellite in the Kunlun area where rupture went very fast to show the very linear picture of the fault that you see on the stage. Now, a year later, there was a Denali earthquake, again a long crack slip event in continental. And it was fortunate that at the time of the earthquake there was a strong motion station here, because the Alaska pipeline goes here. Rupture started here in this complex structure system, then jumped on this tracking fault. And what these authors inferred, they inferred that in order to displace, that in order to explain the record, the near field record here, which was the only near field recording, they said the rupture has to go super shear on the term. For that earthquake, the geometry of the rupture is not so well known because most of the rupture here is glacier high, but it seems to be relatively simple, indeed, a unique point for the rupture. Now, also, what we observe if we look in terms of seismicity, it seems that super shear fault segments have a very different, very characteristic aftershock signature. And in order to explain you the reason we think for that very special signature, I show you this picture taken during the first experiment where people tried to measure fracture speed. And so this is an experiment made by people who worked on cracks in airplanes and in space. They are engineers at Caltech in aeronautics. And for a long time, they were trying to design an experiment to measure fracture speed and here, and the first successful picture. So for me, it's like if you are looking above these meters away by plane, at the time, rupture was propagating on the Sebastian segment. What we have, rupture started here, and at the time, the image is taken, rupture is here. This material deformed elastoplastically, and this deformation can be is what can give this image. But so at the time which image is taken, rupture is here. This would be the P wave energy in front, the deformation in front. But here, what you see, a cone of deformation. This cone is a shock wave, interpreted here. That's a shock wave. It's a planar. Waveform, and it shows that rupture propagates faster than the shear wave of the material. And the angle here is given by basically related to the ratio of rupture speed to shear wave speed. So what is new here compared to wave propagation in classical subrayer rupture is that you have a shock wave. And this shock wave changes considerably the ground motion that you're going to get from this earthquake and changes the stress field. Indeed, this shock wave is going to generate high pressure, to send high pressure throughout the material. Because there's no attenuation. And there will be no attenuation of the stress wave from distance to the fault. So this is, for me, would be the Ismid fault in from above. This would be the rupture fault. And because there's no attenuation of the stress is going to be just as high here as it is here. So in terms of aftershock, what would that mean? I think that means just what we observed, which is shown here. These are the aftershocks of the Ismid earthquake. Remember, the epicenter is around here. Rupture is bilateral. Here to the west, what you see is the rupture is subrelate. You see a very linear arrangement of the aftershock. Here you have two swarms of activity of aftershock activity. They are related, we know, to geothermal activities of the area. But otherwise, a very linear feature which follows the rupture trail. But look at to the west, to the east of the epicenter, very complex. Then it becomes again linear around here. But in that area, very complex pattern of aftershock. And this is the rupture trace at the surface. We know in that area the structure, that the fault is very vertical. Vertical. And even though you are 150 kilometers from here to about here, and you see the aftershock are not associated with the rupture plane. They are off the rupture plane. And indeed, here is where we get the largest sweep at the surface, about 5 meters, and almost no aftershock associated with the rupture plane. So where do they occur? This is the existing fault in that area, the fault which did not break during the earthquake, that which exists in the region. And what we have the impression of seeing is that all these aftershocks occur on secondary faults, but do not occur on the rupture plane itself. And in terms of the shockwave I showed you earlier, this makes a lot of sense because I remind you the stress doesn't attenuate in this sense. The stress generated in the media is the same as the stress generated by the rupture on the fault. And it doesn't attenuate over distance from the fault for a distance for a distance comparable to the depth of faulting. Depth of faulting is about 15 to 20 kilometers, so we expect this shock wave to be about 15 to 20 kilometers also affect the depth 15 to 20 kilometers from the shock. And it's just what we observe. Is it a coincidence? It's up to you to make that to see that. But at least it's an observation. And so why is the rupture plane itself very free of aftershock? And it's because, and I think that's the key to Sutter's here, friction conditions along Sutter's segments are extremely homogeneous, which the rupture doesn't have any reason to stop. Those paths, basically, one major reason is homogeneous friction condition. And because of you have a homogeneous friction condition, the stress is everywhere released on the rupture plane during the earthquake. So you have no concentration of stress after the earthquake. These are just two cross sections of one cross-section of aftershocks to the west of the epicenter where rupture is subrelé. This is just relative to an arbitrary point, but this just tends to define the fault plane, really. But here to the west, to the east, sorry, where rupture is very fast, you see the aftershock zone is quite broad. We did the, so for the second earthquake, we infer the same type of observation. It's a little more complicated to explain because the fault now is hitting to the north. The earthquake started here, and but what you see. That in that very linear area, there's no aftershock. Here you think you have aftershock, but the fault comes to the surface, the fault structure, the fault plane comes to the surface here, is at 12 kilometers here. So these earthquakes, these aftershocks, if they were to occur on the fault plane, they would be very shallow. You see that they are deep. The cross-section here. Not only they are deep, but they are aligned with this old structure, this new structure, as a structure which were pre-existing the development of the North Anatolian fault in that area. So again, what we seem to observe is no aftershock or few aftershocks on the rupture plane itself, where rupture went past, and most of the aftershocks on secondary structure that here the slip has practically end of one. So these are aftershocks related to the end of the rupture. The Kunlun earthquake, these are the major aftershocks of the Kunlun earthquake. First, there are very few aftershocks, the largest one at the magnitude MW 5.6 for an earthquake of which created a, of, which created a 400 kilometer long rupture. It's a small aftershock, relatively small aftershock. But here are the aftershock for which we have the CMT. So they are the largest events. And you see only one of them here as the mechanism of the main shock. So again, these aftershocks are not, these are the major aftershocks in red, and the very large one, largest one is the CMT. But they don't seem, because of their mechanism, to be associated with the rupture itself in most of them. They occur when you are branching here and near the end of rupture.
So, they seem to have the same pattern as before. Now, this is the Denali earthquake in Alaska, for which we have the offshore observation of super-shear rupture, but on a relatively small segment. The segment, these are the magnitude larger than 3 earthquakes aftershocks. Again, the earthquake started here. And where the fast rupture speed was inferred by Ellsworth and Unam and Archuleta from here to about here. And we don't know how it continues, but we know it doesn't continue very long. And you see, remarkably, where we insert fast rupture, you have a gap of aftershock from here to here, except in that area. But this area indeed is the best studied area of the whole aftershock sequence and rupture, because that's where the pipeline goes and the only large highway to that area. Otherwise, it's very deserted area. And what people who study the aftershock and the fault say about that these aftershocks, they say they are not related to, they are not seismic events like the earthquake here, but they are more related to secondary faults, and this is an enlarged view of this term. And that's where you have a net, they call it a nest of faults, of both faults meeting the Denali fault, but none of the larger earthquakes, seen from the mechanism, occur on the rupture plane. So again, what you see, the rupture plane is quite after the earthquake, and but the shockwave activates or reactivates the secondary force in the earth. Another feature is that super-shear is associated with remarkably pure mode-through rupture. This is a pure mode-through, okay? You have two modes of shearing, and mode-2 is prevalent in non-strike slip earthquake. Mode-3 would be prevalent in large subduction earthquake. And mode 3 cannot propagate faster than shear wave. Mode 1 cannot propagate faster than Rayleigh wave. And mode 2 is the only one which can go to the shear from theoretical investigation made in the 1970s. And so what we observe here is that this is in black, and in the dark black circles, you have the horizontal slip measured at the surface. Here you have the lake that you see, and in red is the vertical slip. And you see in all the superficial area, there are very few horizontal motion. Same for the second earthquake, the earthquake. And what is very interesting for the Kunlun earthquake, another person here who's worked extensively on that earthquake is Jewish, and for that earthquake, which is very interesting, is that what you see here in this image, you see the high speed rupture here,
But at the base of the sea, on a fault which parallels the tidal fault, you have some normal fault occurring. And these two faults, this one and the one at the bottom of the hill, the one at the bottom of the hill is one, the one in Tibet, is a topography. Small normal faulting, a length of 70 kilometers, wide, a few kilometers separated from it, the pure tidal motion. And this, so this is the first time people here in this institute exhibition studies that we had in the field very, very nicely. And they claim this is the first time we saw sleep partitioning on two parallel faults during the same event. One fault here with all the pure tactic motion, another fault parallel to it, pure normal faulting motion. And because, again, only one mode of rupture can propagate at fast velocity, we expect some logic for decoupling the mode of rupture with the machine. Indeed, this is by Jan Klinger, who was here, and who is studying the sleep, and you see here for about 50 kilometers the parallel of the two spectrum. The normal fault here, 50 centimeters thick, the fractal fault, 5 meters. So there's an order of magnitude difference in the amount of sleep, but what is remarkable is where the is at the superstructure is at the same pure tidal motion. Now, what about the fault zone? The fault zone is the area around the fault where rupture and where deformation localized, which is a highly fractured zone usually, and which from an experiment of mostly trapped wave made originally under the idea of Keaki and started at UFC under his guidance showed that there's usually a zone around a tri-tip fault, a zone about 100 meters wide where highly fractured, where the speed of the wave is greatly diminished, maybe by 50% as much as 50%. So this is what we observe in that area here. I won't go into that, but this is observed here. This is, okay, these new structures are from here to here. This is the new structure here. But we made experiments on these fourth zone of that area and we found, I just showed you what you found is that area which is where we have several structures here. For instance, this is recording. This is a recording of an aftershock in that area. And the stations are very close to space, one here, this one is really on the fault, one G acceleration. This is about 20 meters away. The amplitude is much less, and this is about 200 meters away from the fault space, and the amplitude is totally diminished. And this we attribute to this fault zone effect, which amplifies ground motion near the fault, and this is Benzine model of the highly fractured fault zone, and he made several experiments in the same area I just showed, and here you see the trapped wave. The difference between here and here is that here, okay, you have recordings of an aftershock, but here again you are at the fault phase, here you are 200 meters, about 200 meters. High amplification in the
information is available at the different applications that you can just report. Now, we made an experiment on the area without knowing, before knowing the culture was fast in that area. We made an experiment looking at the problem in that area where we have Satoshi. And we used many configurations of geophones. We used also vibrating tracks. And this is one of the results. Basically what you have an array of geophones. Here you have the phone. Here you go almost 100 meters away from it. And you don't see tracks, but this is recording of one aftershock. This is another aftershock further away. But basically the amplitude doesn't change for 400 meters from the fourth phase to the western thing here. And regardless of the configuration we use, you could not find a zone of reduced velocity. So full zone characteristics and rupture dynamics may also be linked. And I will reach the conclusion. Surface faults are remarkably simple and linear geometry. They are remarkably quiet after the earthquake, after shock occur from the fault on secondary structure. And the 100 meter fault zone, I mean, older 100 meter fault zone, which is, has become a classical representation of fault. Seems to be absent in the case of Satoshi. And as theoretically predicted, Satoshi is associated with remarkably pure mode 2 rupture. And our interpretation of this observation is that friction along Satoshi segment is quite homogeneous. This is the key to Satoshi. As the friction properties are homogeneous along the fault, the stress is everywhere released during the earthquake, there's no need for aftershock on the rupture plane. The shockwave radiated by the Sutter shear rupture activates or reactivates secondary structures located off the fault plane. And as the shockwave doesn't attenuate with distance from the fault, at least for 10, let's say 10 kilometers for distance which is comparable to the depth of Ophir in theory, the 100 meter wide fault zone.